Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 16th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Pete Goddard. Today's session number is 99-1 and is titled, Parenting in the Year 2000. Is it really any different than it used to be? Let's listen in.
My name is Pete Goddard, and I have a disclaimer here to read for you, first off, before we get started, so you don't take anything too seriously in here. I'm really glad to be here. It's been 9 years since I've been up here teaching, and last time I was here, it was very white, and I kind of like it with the snow. It's very different then, but I'm glad that you are all here this morning. So I'm a social worker. I work primarily with kids and families from basically school age and their families. I've been doing it for almost going on 20 years now. Currently in Seattle, but like 20 years before that in North Carolina. Although I'm originally from New Jersey, so it's like I'm confused. But I really love being in Seattle now. In working as a therapist, I have parents a lot of times, and sometimes teenagers that come to my office and they're looking for answers. Okay? Or they're looking for some relief from the pain or some peace or whatever it might be. And I frequently tell them that they're not going to find it from me because I don't have it to give. That's, you know, it's not like I've got what hidden somewhere that, you know, and I'm hiding it from you and I'm only going to give it to you if you come and see me. I mean, what is this? No. The way that I do counseling and do therapy with families and with kids is in the relationship. And it is in the relationship that the therapeutic relationship, if you want to, you know, the proper term for it there, is that within the context of that relationship that the healing and the peace and the knowledge can be gained. And so I want you to kind of keep in mind that the same thing that's going on in here. I haven't got all the answers. I haven't got many answers. I don't know. It's like, you know, but if we were to go around and add up the years of parenting experience in this room, wow. And so it is in the relationship, in the community that is developed here in this hour and afterwards that can make the difference. You may be wondering, you know, why I do these kind of workshops, because I have some limitations that some of you don't have. And some of you have much more experience than I do. First of all, I'm not a parent. I'm like, well, wait a minute, how can we be talking about parenting and kids and that kind of stuff? And I tend to go more at times from the child's perspective than I do from the parent's perspective, since I was a child. Sometimes still people refer to me as being childish, so I still have that in me, but I don't have the parent side. Although, I've been offered children. It's good friends of mine in Seattle, Ted Marine, who years ago used to work up here, and asked me to be the godfather. Godfather, said right this time? I was mixed up godfather, godson. Godfather for Benjamin, who's now just turned 5. So what's my job? You know, being the godfather of Ben. So, you know, the typical stuff, remembering his birthdays and holidays and this kind of stuff. And when he becomes a teenager, he lives with you. And then when he's human again, you can send him back. You know, it's, And I've run group homes. Was it the family here that's from Salem, Virginia? They still at Lutheran Children's Home of the South. I've been a house parent in a cottage with 12 girls, and survived that, and learned a lot. Especially that I don't want to ever do that again. But all the stuff that I'm going to be kind of presenting to you, and that we're going to be developing together. Please keep in mind that I am not a parent. And so there is no way that here I can know what that is like. Here, yeah, but there's a difference in there. And keep that in mind, please, okay? So, let's see if I covered everything on here. Okay, good enough. So, in getting started, we're gonna figure out, all right, first of all, what is the role of a parent? What's your job description? What are you supposed to be doing with your children?
Care and feeding.
Care and feeding, okay.
Meeting their basic physical needs.
A friend of mine years ago, a very wise woman, told me that when you're writing on the board, if you can't spell, if you write sloppily enough, people aren't quite sure. So penmanship or your spelling, so they usually won't say something. If you write very neatly, it's very obvious that you don't spell. Okay, care and feeding, the physical needs. What else?
Having a relationship with your children.
Okay.
Support the creation of good self-esteem.
Say that again, please. Support?
The establishment of good self-esteem.
Okay.
Preparing them to be, I think one of the most important things is preparing them to function when they're no longer with us, to be adults, to be
independent,
positive members of society.
Be independent. Which is the hardest?
The easiest is the care and feeding.
That's why I started.
Okay.
Self-esteem is.
Think the self-esteem is the hardest. Okay. All right. Which one?
Independence, letting go.
To let them go.
Now, again, I'm not a parent, and over the years, I've had kids live with me who. Either their parents are driving them crazy or the kids are driving the parents crazy. So they live with me for a while. And that would be hard for me to do, you know? And, you know, having a child, either giving birth or adopting or foster care or whatever it might be kind of stuff, to have a child and to, like, you know, okay, go. Yeah.
I think we all accept that has to happen and we all try to make it happen, but the speed at which it happens. We have a difference of opinion between the parent and the child as to how fast that process should be.
Are you reading my notes?
No.
Thank you.
I have a 14-year-old, we're right there.
It's a perfect lead-in, okay? Because if you kind of think that, all right, here we are, either at birth or when you adopt your child, it is like you're one. Mm-hmm. And if you give birth even before birth, you are one. And from birth on, this needs to start taking place. All right? And so if this is the parent here, kind of going along, and you know, kind of, you know, somewhat steady or whatever, and here's the child, and from birth, the idea is to start separating, individuating, if you want to use it a more clinical term. And there are times when it kind of, like, you know, it does this. Right? But generally, it needs to kind of, you know, work its way, whatever. And you're right, there's usually a conflict between what the parent thinks the child needs to be and to have, how much independence they should have, and what the child thinks. Now, as you go along, and then there are natural types of ups and downs. You know, the two-year-old that will, you know, they're mobile, you know, and they're going, and they're out there. And, like, you know, you're in the room with them, and, you know, they go around, and they get over here, and they're kind of like, you know, behind the piano, and they're doing something, and they can't see you. And it's like, oh my gosh, you know, it's like this panic. And, you know, they find you. They come running for you, they give you this death grip, and they hang on for, you know, like, you know, you're like, well, what happened? You know? Well, in the child's mind, you left is what happened. All right? Now. And so, you know, boom, right back again kind of stuff. And they get what they need here from you, and they're off again. Mm-hmm. Now, you may be like, well, maybe you didn't get enough of that hug from them. And they're like, you know, let me go, I'm going to get out of here kind of stuff. That's the classic stuff, and it's played out throughout life. Okay? Now, I typically get them when they're like preteen or teenagers. And I have to try to help the family figure out what is it that's going on. Is it that the child needs more independence and doesn't know how to do it? Or is it that the parents are holding the child too close? The child knows how to do it, the parent won't let them. Or is it that the child is too close, wants to stay close, and the parent wants them to kind of, you know, which is it? Because you deal with those situations in different ways. Did I ever tell them to turn the tape on?
No.
Oh, well. I imagine that, would they know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hold they on. Do now.
They do now? Oh, well. I just thought of that. So, the idea is like, oh, you had it on? It's been 9 years. I'm just like, you know, it's like, you know, I'm not used to being taped. Anyway, so that's going on. So that separation aspect, yeah, can be really difficult. The other things actually are easier to deal. They come in to my office with these needs, especially a lot of kids that come in that are in foster care. Okay. Physical needs, here relationship is more the emotional needs, teaching parents somehow how to be able to deal with their children to help them meet their emotional needs, doing that. Support and self-esteem, again, that stuff is, and from my perspective as a therapist working with kids and families, is more workable. This is the tough one. Because what you're dealing with sometimes are parents who, the ones that are kind of holding the kids closer is because they're needing the child for them to feel good. Their life is the child. And if this child leaves, what do they have left? And that can be a really touchy situation in helping a parent be able to deal with that. And what happens is it confuses the child because the child is ready to go, but they love their parents. And they see the pain that is causing their parents for them to go, and they're like, I don't want to hurt my parents. But yet they're a teenager, and they're like, well, I can't. I hate my parents. You know, it's like, you know, so it's like, where do they stand then? And you see how confusing it can get in that type of situation. Well, now, so what does this have to do with the year 2000 then, is that I think this is becoming much more complicated. And we want to take a look at how that is becoming more complicated. So I'm going to put you all to work. This is not a kind of session where you just get to sit. All right? You notice already the back rubs and everything. You know, you got to do some active kind of stuff. What I want to do is kind of divide you into three different groups. And in those three different groups, this is what I want you to come up with on this newsprint here. That I have three, not quite generations, but three time periods. The first time period is from the 1940s to the 1960s. The second time period is the 60s to the 80s, then from the 80s to the year 2000. And what I want you to do is to write down, just quickly, short, abbreviate, one or two words, things such as events, people, or technology that influenced families during that time period.
Okay?
Know your assignments are?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Well, let's start with the 40s to 60s back here, okay? We need your wisdom, sir. Need a marker. So we have a group back there. How about from the 60s to the 80s back in that corner? And then up here, the 80s to now. How about if I give you like not even 10 minutes to do this? Just do it quickly. Not a whole lot of discussion.
Okay, so oh, I'm sorry, John. I'm just
going to
grab
down.
Down. Oh,
spelling doesn't count.
We're a real small group up here.
Okay.
First one, we'll discuss it some, kind of go on through each one then. So the 1940s to the 1960s. Some of us were born back in that time frame, some were not. World War II, Cold War, Korean War, aftermath of the Great Depression, increased birth rate, technology, the automobile, interstate, TV, radio, space race, technological,
education,
mobility, suburbia, oh yes, increased divorce rate, sexual revolution, anti-war movement, hippies, beatniks. What?
We overlapped a little bit because in the 60s we did a lot of those same ones.
Brown versus Board of Education.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. FDR social programs. Ike. MacArthur. Truman. Through the Kennedys. Walt Disney.
Yeah.
MLK.
Martin
Luther King. Norman Vincent Peale, Dr. Spock, Elvis Presley, Beatles. Okay. Now, as we look through this in general, okay, if you were to kind of, which ones kind of stand out for you as having a major kind of influence? Yeah.
What I noticed in comparison to working on the other end of the spectrum was that list was focused on people and events. And our list was, we couldn't think of people and events. We had inventions and technology.
Ah.
And so it's just real clear that there were really different kinds of lists. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I think there were people that were very admired on that first list.
Yeah. Okay. That are having a positive influence that you kind of look up to, that you could say to your children or so and so, you know. Yeah. As opposed to now, was it, you know, be like Mike or something? It's Michael Jordan. It was like, wasn't it commercial, wasn't it? You know,
yeah.
Be like Mike or
yeah.
Michael Jordan's your icons.
Also, there were things that sort of unified people on this list. And on our list, things that
pulled you together.
Yeah.
The war kind of stuff, depression.
We also had mobility and suburbia.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is
the beginning
of that, yes. Yeah, when my parents moved from Long Island, New York, to, as my grandparents say, God's country, New Jersey. Well, the Garden State. You know, it was like, you know, they were just aghast. Of course, they moved to the United States from Germany, so how can they talk, you know? It's like, but anyway, so yeah, that mobility type of stuff.
And respect for political figures, I never heard any questions, so, you know, it's like, you trusted the government.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Some real beginnings of technology, TV, radio, that kind of thing, but I think, especially at the beginning of that period, it was more unifying than a dividing because it was limited in time period and the family came together to listen and to watch. Even people from other homes came because there weren't so many of them and things like that. So those had a different, I think there was a different way of looking at those.
With Walt Disney, how many remember, you know, Sunday nights?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah.
It's all of them, too.
Yeah.
When you said Walt Disney, this is kind of a turning point came when I remember the night the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan.
Me too.
And it caused a rift in our family because my teenage brothers and sisters wanted to watch Ed Sullivan and my dad wanted to watch Walt Disney like we always did. And we compromised. We flipped back and forth.
You'll wear out the channel, Jay, if you do that, you know.
We did it with a can opener. Because it was already
coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, back then, I wasn't there, but I know that it was more of a common culture. You had three networks to choose from. Now you have 300. People, you knew the music of the age, and now it's just so varied, and just that we are moving. Everyone's got their headphones on now instead of listening to the music that, you know, came from the radio that everyone gathered around, and people aren't getting to know each other as much as they did just by the common culture that there was back then. We don't really have it.
Part of what we need to force ourselves to remember is that one of the reasons there was a commonness to the culture in the 40s and 50s and through most of the 60s is our society remained mobilized on a war footing for that entire period.
Yeah.
It was the first time in U.S. history that that had ever happened, that after World War II, the efforts, warlike efforts of the Depression and then World War II, that we did not demobilize but stayed on a war footing, kept our military forces at full complements, and mobilized our industry, the development of suburbs, and all of it was the continuation and the beginning of what we now call the federal debt. And it plowed tons of money into our society. We rebuilt the entire world. They bought stuff from us. They needed our things. So we kept our industry was at full force until finally in the late 60s, the steel industry started to collapse and so on because they didn't need our goods anymore. And so on. So we were on a war footing. It's a major factor of why we had this sense of unity.
Yeah.
But I think it was sometimes a false sense of unity too. It was what was required of you at that point in time. My parents seem to be a theme with me these 2 weeks. I don't know what's happened here, but my parents were immigrants in the United States, and they got married after World War II, having both come from Latvia, and I was born in 1952 here, and we live in a small town in Ohio that had very few people who were different in any way there, and you did everything you could to be like everybody else. It was not fun to stand out in any way, and you were supposed to be. If you weren't like everybody else, then you were questionable.
And just to follow up quickly, this is the period when the House of Representatives had a committee, a standing committee called Un-American Activities.
Right. Yeah. I was like, well, Parker's on that list, and that's one that we kind of jumped over, but then.
Yeah. I noticed something that's absent, and it may reflect the group, the individuals, all those who were doing this, but we do not have any sports figures there at all. And there are two, I think, probably we ought to consider there, Jackie Robinson and Will Chamberlain, because they were instrumental in breaking the barrier.
Yeah, all right.
Just to follow up on that, I live in Canada now, and that was the immigrants, they were different. They kept their ethnic background. All the Dutch farmers who came to Ontario kept that Dutch going, and the Christian Reformed churches were very big, and that was where their community was. And so when you're talking about everybody being unified in Canada at that time, I don't think that's the case. I think you had a ton of immigrants, many, many more than I've ever met here in the States. First and second generation Canadians are very common right now. And so they were pulling in as their own countries.
Yeah.
So you had the Dutch coming in and the Germans coming in.
Okay.
Well, I think this point that we're on, it's important to distinguish between what was the expectation and what was the reality.
Wow.
Somebody else talked about that in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s, at least, the expectation is uniformity and assimilation. I remember having a conversation with a neighbor of mine when we were in graduate school whose parents were second generation Eastern European Jews, and she talked about how her mother cooked out of the ladies' magazines. You know, you want to have Jell-O, you want to have all these bland American foods. For the reason you have Jell-O is because if you have electricity, then you have a refrigerator, then you can make Jell-O. So although we don't usually think of it anymore, Jell-O as a status symbol, it was initially because you couldn't make it unless you had electricity. But there was that expectation of assimilation and uniformity doesn't necessarily mean that it was the reality.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's kind of like jump down to this middle time frame here from the 1960s to the 1980s. Again, things that have influenced families. Vietnam, Watergate, the hippie movement, TV pervasiveness, computers, Beatles, Martin Luther King, Kennedy assassinations, Kent State, SDS,
Students for Democratic
Society,
Civil Rights Movement, Dr. Spock, the peak there, Woodstock, Draft Dodgers, Modern Art, Alternative Education, Feminism, Working Mothers, School Consolidation in Districts, Travel, Moonwalk, Woman's Ordination. Communes, health food, drugs, physical fitness boom, self-awareness, self-help type stuff. Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers, urban decay. Okay, so we're making a shift here. Yeah.
I was struck, I graduated from high school in 1970, so that's supposed to be right in the middle of this. And how many of these, first of all, the individual became much more important. It was okay to be different. And the questioning of the establishment, a lot of these events caused families in general to, I think that was when the beginning of the breakup of some of the establishment things that were considered, like the government you could always trust on, and this sort of thing. So that most of these events were kind of cataclysmic. You look at Vietnam, Watergate, all the assassinations. That's when kids started really questioning, I think, the order of things because of all this big stuff that happened.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I was born in 1968, and I remember that this film that came on, it was this TV program that came on, and I thought I'd watch it. It was the 25th anniversary of 1968. And I watched it, and it was, they had all the TV footage of the assassinations and then the Vietnam protests and things that were going on. And you think, well, why would anybody want to have a child during this time?
Good question.
And that's kind of why I'm here. And I'm thinking, why would anyone want, I teach kids, and that's one of the things my husband and I are wondering. Well, you know, I know everyone says, well, it's great, but, you know, with everything that's going on in the world, and I'm sure people thought that way back in the 40s or as long as it's been, why would you want to bring a child into this world and look at all these nasty things? But I turned out fine. And so I just think, you know, there are awful things that happen. I know it brings us back to parenting, and then what happens, how are you a parent about this?
Yeah. I sort of have an answer to that question. My husband and I were married in 1966, and we'd been married 9 months, and we went to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I was teaching school in Minneapolis at the time. I was in the inner city. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Mm-hmm. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. I flew into Washington, D.C. and saw fires, about six of them in D.C. I went to see my in-laws on them. And we had a child in 1970. He made it home from Vietnam. The Vietnam War, we were hopeful that it was going to be better. Yeah. That was behind us. And our daughter, who's 29, is up here now, mm-hmm. and she's fine too. But we were optimistic. We really wanted to be parents mm-hmm. because we felt like we'd be good parents and we could make a contribution. But we did drop off the face of the earth and went to the wilderness of Montana. Mm-hmm. I know that that was a reaction to the Vietnam thing, and my husband just needed time to heal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, so we were hopeful. That's the answer to your question.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right.
I was just going to comment when you said, why would anybody choose to have children? It wasn't until the later end of that middle section that that was really much of a choice.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's something that went on there. Whether or not you became a parent, it wasn't much of a choice until that.
Families when they have, you know, like, you know, four kids or more or whatever kind of stuff, they have, like, you know, 1.5 or 2 years apart and then 6 years and another kid.
Oh, that was exactly my point.
Okay.
That was the first time you could ask that question.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, so probably something else. I don't know if it's up there or not. I didn't hear it. It's the pill.
The pill.
Although the size of families had been getting smaller, mm-hmm. so it's, I mean, certainly the pill was a huge revolution, and I don't want to discount that at all, but nonetheless, the size of families had been getting smaller for several decades by the 60s.
Yeah.
She just brought up something that was a big pitch for responsible parents, ZPG.
Zero population growth.
Yeah. And anyone that had more than two kids was, you know, polluting the, overpopulating the earth with unwanted children.
Yeah.
I was going to say, too, if you read it in the magazines, they blame a lot of this on working moms. Now, how true that is, I don't know. But that did make a big shift in how everything was done with daycare and the mother not being home when the kids came home. And I am a working mom. I'm a teacher, so in the summer I'm home. But there's times even now when I kind of think, geez, I wish I was there after school. This would have gotten done. And that was a big shift that had to happen maybe, but it did change the way families function.
Yeah.
I think there's another thing that's done on Angeles, and that's in terms of inflation, because that is, that really impacted.
Just during this time period, yeah. Inflation was. Yeah. Okay.
Isn't that what it was, 20% interest to buy a house? No, so,
I remember my sister and her husband, like, yeah, 17, 18% interest on a house.
Late
70s,
right? Early.
Yeah. Okay. 80s to the year 2000. MTV. You can imagine back here. MTV.
At the top of the list, yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's look at, okay, Nintendo, computers, the internet, peer pressure, drug abuse, more available, cheap, booming economy, teens have more money. Oh my gosh, yes. Two-parent working families, single-parent families, more prevalent, early maturation, physically, socially, emotionally, more daycare, no draft, no nationalism, which was strong back here.
Yeah.
No positive role models or something society needed. Where is this?
Teens, there's no need for teens in our society. We don't need them to work. We don't need them to take care of our kids. They just don't have a role.
They don't have a role.
Where except is that? Wait.
Yeah. Okay. Ah. Lack of patriotism. Poor examples as role models: athletes, politicians, actors. Decline of manners, moral scandals, Clinton, O.J. Simpson, Daryl Strawberry, yeah. Family unit has changed. Extended families not nearby. Convenience eating, oh, that's a good one, yeah. Focus on nutrition, exercise. Okay, so, what are you seeing? Kind of like, you know, over this time frame, what's happening? What's making, back here, being able to individuate, what's making that more difficult?
I think we're afraid to let them go because there's so much more stuff out there.
And yet they're being pulled.
They want it sooner
because of all of the MTV and all the kinds of role models and daycare and early math.
Nowadays, two-thirds of children are being raised in daycare. Two-thirds of the children.
And kids are more independent in daycare. It's a requirement.
And look at back here. Yeah, and it's a pseudo kind of independence, though. Right. That's the thing. Because you look back here, you know, who is raising children back here? Who's raising them here?
Yeah.
The lowest paid workers, basically, in the workforce.
Yeah. On the maturation, physically, socially, emotionally, but not economically. It's harder as a youth to be out there and you can pay for your own apartment. And that's where you get the returning child back to your home. Yeah. You become a storage site.
Yeah.
And the animal collector of all of your youth.
What I'm saying is that the physically maturing early, yes. Socially, somewhat. Emotionally,
No.
There was much more emotional maturity, I think, back here. There was a camp that I teach at each year in New Hampshire. Another church camp, and one of the women spoke was talking about how her grandfather, and she was about my age, in the mid-40s, and she's talking about how her grandfather, when he was like in the sixth grade, and his friend was like in the fifth grade, they rode their bicycles, one of those old clunky bicycles, across the state of New York by themselves, the two of them, a fifth and a sixth grader. Now, can you think of fifth and sixth graders you know today? That would be, first of all, parents would let them do that, but would it be even safe for them to do it? Before interstates, you know, back roads, they'd stop at farms, they'd work for a while for a place to eat and stay, and they made their way across the state of New York. And she was talking about how he would periodically refer to that as what, how that helped him to separate, individuate. Didn't use those terms, but also in him being, you know, his own person, talk about self-confidence, being able to do something like that, being successful at it, it being really hard to do. There's mountains. Those old bikes don't have speeds on them, you know, kind of stuff. And so it was like, you know, this maturity then is it's a really tough thing that I see sometimes.
Well, it's not safe now, and there's nothing on that list about violence. And when I grew up in Washington in the 60s, Washington was burning, and yet I'd be outside all night in the alleys, and it was safe, and everyone knew everybody. And
nowadays, in the state of Washington, every 5 days, someone under the age of 18 is killed by a handgun. Back in Minnesota, every 7 days. In North Carolina, where I just moved from, every 2 days. Someone under the age of 18 is killed by a handgun.
No.
They didn't have the statistics back then. But can you imagine back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s? I mean, it's like, it is a different world. So, again, not being a parent, I'm scared about sending kids out on their own at times. It's so neat, you know, this environment up here, to be able to send your kids out, you don't see them all day, but you know they're with other staff around here or whatever it might be, and you're like, what an experience for them to be able to do that in a safe environment. But then you have to teach them that this is different up here than it is maybe back at home. And you can't really do it as easy back at home.
We live in a relatively urban, or I mean rural, 4,000 people in the middle of nowhere town in the little cornfields. And yeah, there's drugs and all that kind of stuff, and you have to be careful. The kids all know who the druggies are. But our kids tend to be a little bit naive when they go into bigger city situations. And, you know, they really don't know. My daughter said, well, Mom, why do I have to lock the door? You know, it's not even in the comfort where you're safe anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, being that, you have a question?
Or just the shift to just retrospect, the sense of belonging to things. People don't join in the 40s and 60s. People joined all kinds of things, scouts and VFWs and all that kind of stuff. But even in the church, from the 80s to 2000, just that whole sense of people wanting to join stuff. Everything is just way, way down, including bowling leagues, everything else, across the board. So it makes community difficult. You don't belong to anything, and that makes parenting different and more difficult.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean, nobody else on there said, and I just thought of this, that kids have scheduled themselves to death. You know, you read this, like the paper, they're doing, piano lessons and sports and all that stuff, that they don't have time to be a kid. And you hear an awful lot about that too, that they, that they're so scheduled that they don't have time to just be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But is it the kid's schedule?
Or the parents'
schedule. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you look at then as far as like, what's going on within the family? More of a family with two parents here than there is in the 80s and 90s. Families where you have extended family, not necessarily blood related, but neighbors. How many of you remember, we're talking earlier, where we grew up, even in New Jersey, where all the neighbors knew us kids, and go to the school, and when I got there, and the school was 4th through 12th grade, the teachers knew you so well, and your parents. We were talking before that if you did something wrong, the teacher would give you the look, and that would do it. Behavior-wise, the manners and all. When I was in high school, there was and trigonometry. I should have never been in trigonometry, but and I was like in the back of the class, my eyes half open, and the teacher asked me, "Do I want a pillow?" And I said, "Yes." It seemed to make sense at the time, and so she sent me to the principal's office. And go to the principal's office, and the principal was like, we're talking, and shooting the breeze kind of stuff. And he realized in the middle of the class, he goes, "What are you doing here?" And I explained to him, and he gave me the look, and he said, "Get out of here." And I mean, it really made me feel bad about it, because I knew this guy since I was in fourth grade. And my fear was, oh my God, my parents might find out. He didn't have to call my parents, because he knew me. Now, how often are kids in schools for more than a couple years at a time, where the teachers and the staff know the students? So much is changing, moving around, going to different schools, bigger, better schools kind of stuff. One of the Bible sessions, we're talking about better and more is always what you're looking for?
Well, just back what you were saying about how you were held accountable and everybody knew you, and it just took a look. Our town had the opportunity to have Mary Pfeiffer come and speak, and she wrote Reviving Ophelia, and she told a story about when she was a little girl and she was walking, you know, somewhere, and she stopped and picked flowers out of a lady's yard. And that lady knew her by name, and she called her mother and told her that she had picked his flowers. And she says that was how we used to grow up, was everybody knew you, you were held accountable for your actions. And now you would be afraid to go out and confront a child or a teenager for doing something in the front yard, because who knows what they're going to do back. We don't know who they are.
The context and frame of reference of people, there it's your community, maybe nationally, growing globally between the 60s, and now it's intergalactically. People, kids are so, you know, aliens, ho-hum, they see it all the time in their literature and in their movies. It's a much bigger context and frame of reference that they have.
Yeah.
One of the things that we have on the 80s to 2000 are drugs that are abused. What we don't have is drugs that are prescribed. We are obviously in the Prozac generation, and I'm a physician and I can claim some guilt in that. But the thing that impresses me is the still significant number of suicides, and I deal a lot with problem children in my work. And I'm trying to recall, if I can accurately, what the suicide rate may have been in the 40s to 60s compared to what the suicide rate is now, when we supposedly have chemicals that will treat depression and prevent that kind of thing from happening. And I don't have the accurate data, but I don't have a feel that we've made any gains.
No, have not. And I just, it was maybe a month ago, got a call from the hospital if I could see someone the next day, and I did. And as a young man who's 16, is going to be a junior in high school, and model student, you know, great grades, behaves well at home, all this kind of stuff. And the parents were just like baffled, you know, what was going on? And of course, you know, in helping them to look at, you know, what was going on, and that there was a lot of things their son was saying, you know, like, for the past 2 years, you know, mom, dad, you know, I feel bad about stuff, I really need to talk to someone. And the parents were like, well, you can talk to us, you know, kind of stuff. And said, no, I really need to talk to someone. They just, you know, they're just blowing it off all the time. Until his writing got so graphic about how he was going to kill himself and making a suicide attempt. And that it was like, you know, yeah, you know, what's going on? You know, how come we're not seeing this? And what kind of pressure is there on kids, and the lack of the emotional support that kids got back here? Okay?
There's another, one of the things in emotionally, we say maturation emotionally, I also deal with troubled children, and I see some of them in a very phony way, pretending to be almost psychologists themselves. I'll hear them say, you know, and they don't have any in really depth to some of this. There's a lot of phoniness about what they think is real. They think they're solving the problem, and it's a real big issue, I think, we need to look at.
I was going to say two things that kind of go back to the Prozac and the, I mean, it's the time. We don't give the time to these kids that they may need, or they're so busy themselves, and we look at convenience. Let's give them, don't read this book or a pill, or, you know, we'll sit in front of the TV for a while, or because, you know, it interrupts our busy schedule, or and that they're missing the relationships, and even in school, it's so easy for teachers to, I got this great computer program, and they'll love it, and they can sit in front of a computer all day, but they're missing the relationships, and I mean, there's all kinds of areas where that comes in. It's convenience. And, you know, giving them the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Teaching has changed so much in the 20 years I've been doing it, and I think one of the saddest things, and two things come to mind here, they tell us now, don't hug a kid when they come in because you can get sued for, they're going to think you're a sexual pervert. Well, I'm sorry, when I got a first grader come to my class, I'm giving them a hug on the way in the door. And you're there's so many things you can't do now because we've been litigated to death. The tie your hands, the other thing is your tie your hands are in terms of, you know, you're so, Dr. Spock, whether you blame him or not totally for this, but you can't damage their little psyches, so you're not allowed to discipline a kid, and that's a bad word. Discipline's a bad word. And I have found in my teaching that the teachers that demand the most of themselves and of their students are the ones that kids respect and remember, not the easy ones. Yeah. Kids are looking for limits, and we don't set them anymore.
And that, yeah, that's a whole other session about limit setting and discipline and how that all has gotten confused and messed up and everything.
That's part of the parenting problem.
Yeah.
I'm having a little problem with this because we're glorifying the 40s to the 60s.
Yeah.
And I think back then it was okay to talk about problems that were going into the families.
Yeah.
And I think that abuse and things that happened then was really nicely covered up. Mm-hmm. And then we have those people who are not given support who then become parents and the cycle repeats itself. So in the 80s to year 2000, it's okay to go to a psychologist, it's okay to start talking about these things. We then have the people who come back and say that, you know, what you're coming up with in the stories are untrue, false memory syndrome people. But I think we need to not glorify the 1940s and 50s. I think those families were not. We just would like to think they were.
Yeah. I mean, I admit one of the reasons that I'm a therapist is because I was raised in one of those families where you just don't talk about anything. And, you know, the damage that I think that does to being able to talk about things. Yeah.
But I think one thing about the 40s and 50s is that a lot of proliferation of crime was not advertised. Now you've got TV, you've got all these news agencies that more or less cater to publicizing, you know, all the bad things that have been happening in society. So who's going to pick it up? It's going to be the kids who are going to see this stuff. And they're going to, you know, get a lot of copycat things going on, a little, you know, getting influenced from Molly's bad media presentations.
So what is going on now that's good?
Well, I think kind of taking off from what you just said, that parents are talking more, at least the parents that I know, are talking more with their children about lots of different issues and kind of helping children process how we live. That's my experience. Maybe some people have different experiences, but even in my family growing up, I think I had a pretty healthy family, but there were a lot of things you just didn't.
Sure. And men are much more nurturing toward their children now than they used to be.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned the problem with daycare and the fact that most daycare workers are both underqualified in terms of what we would think of children's development needs being or whatever, but they're so terribly underpaid that they don't want to go work there anyway. There are some changes going on. I think we're waking up to recognize that if this is the case, if daycare is a reality, if two working parents is going to be the wave of the future, it's here and we already have to deal with it. In North Carolina, you mentioned that you have experience there, that's where I live. And we have a program that's a model program for the nation called Smart Start, where we have really focused on spending money to educate and provide a supplement for daycare. And we're spending now $152 million a year out of state taxes to see that daycares are better staffed and better available. Now, you can argue, is that the way to go? Should we be providing out of the tax dollar a method, a supportive method that may not necessarily be the best one? And the only caveat that I would like to see us put in there, which we have actually not done, is I'd like to see us be able to use the same amount of money that we pay for the daycare to pay a mother to stay home if she desired to do that, to provide the same result for a child.
Yeah.
In the Bible study this morning, Barbara Rossin brought up that the conventional wisdom of the day is that more is better and that we have to have more of everything. And I think that's what fosters a lot of two-parent working family. I'm not saying everybody, but a lot of two parents working because we want to have more for our children, we want to have more convenience, more of this. And so to try to pull away from that wisdom and doesn't bring us joy or peace or happiness. So to somehow fight that.
Yeah.
I think cost of living and housing costs force a lot of people to both work. I know that's true in our situation. And I think that we moved from this 60s and the 70s where women had choices about staying at home or going to college and getting a career to the 80s and the 90s of, is it really a choice? Or is it just a reality?
Or is it a harder choice?
It's a harder choice.
Is it having to give up a house?
Right.
Or, you know, kind of stuff.
If one of the things that we said we want to do for our kids is help them become responsible and to use their gifts, I'm very uncomfortable with this sudden, oh, well, you just work to make money. I work because I have talents that are useful to more people. I'm not just working. I mean, if I didn't get paid for it, I'd still want to work because I'm making a contribution there. So I'm very uncomfortable with that assumption that two people earning a living suddenly means you have a crummy family.
I thank you.
Yes. And a lot of women who don't make money are very busy doing other things besides being at home with children. Or men who are out making money are at home with their children in the 40s and 50s. So I think that's a far too simple solution to very complicated.
Oh, yeah, there isn't. Right. Yeah. There isn't any simple solution at all. And we're kind of out of time for today. And I thank you for your wisdom and your help in being able to begin. And again, the idea of this is just to begin this kind of discussion. And that it doesn't end here. That you continue it elsewhere and with other people also. That's the process that we want to get started. That's what can make a difference. Not just coming here and just leave it here. Okay. All right. I hope you have a good afternoon. I hear the sun's coming out later.
Thank you. Promises, promises.